Good afternoon. We're going to open the Senate Education Committee today, April 25th, 2017. And if you saw our agenda, you'll know we always start at the bottom and move up. So at least today we will begin with a informal, open an informational meeting around Special Olympics. And with that, we'll have our first panel come up. And thank you for being here. It's an important program, and it's really nice that you're willing to be here to talk a little bit about an organization that I've dealt with.
I've seen these people somewhere.
Well, it makes it really nice, Mr. Chairman, when we know that we have Special Olympics in every district of every senator.
That's true.
We feel right at home.
Thanks.
So, well, let me begin so we won't keep the committee. I know you have a full agenda. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Governor Barbara Roberts, and I am an enthusiastic member of the Board of Directors of Special Olympics Oregon. We are very grateful for this invitation to speak to the Senate Education Committee today about Special Olympics, an organization that profoundly impacts children and youth both with and without disabilities in Oregon schools. Let me first thank you for your public service. Legislative service is not easy. I have been in your shoes, and I have not forgotten how hard it is. Budget challenges and competing interests over short dollars are a constant pressure, but we need good people in government, and I appreciate your stepping forward to serve and to give us this opportunity today. Now, I do not come to Salem to testify in a committee meeting very often. I would not be here if this were a minor matter. I'm here today because I know the critical importance of the issues we're discussing. I know what it means to the quality of life for tens of thousands of children and youth in Oregon schools, and I know what it means to our entire education system. In the next few minutes, you will hear about one of the best-kept secrets in this state. The work of Special Olympics Oregon. You know the brand. Everyone knows the brand. But today, you will learn why this organization is one of the most significant partners this state has, and how Special Olympics is helping Oregon meet major government directives and mandates. The fact is, Special Olympics Oregon has stepped up for several years and assumed a leadership role in response to these government mandates. Now, we are asking for your help. We'd like to begin by providing some important general background for you today. So Carrie's going to be next, and then we'll move on and try to give you as much information as we can in this short time.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carrie Timchek, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Historical Society. In addition, I've just completed four terms as Board Chair of Special Olympics Oregon and continue to serve as an active member of the Board of Directors. I'm proud as well to be a constituent of Senator Haas, and my father and my brother are proud to be a constituent of Senator Roblin. So we got two of you covered up there. So let me first provide some general background for you on Special Olympics.
I would point out that Reedsport is in Douglas County.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So Special Olympics Oregon. Special Olympics Oregon serves the largest disability population in the state, individuals with intellectual disabilities, medically referred to as mental retardation. This is also the largest disability population in any state and includes a wide range of causes and degrees of disability, including significant autism. Many of our participants also have a physical disability as well. Currently, Special Olympics Oregon has over 14,000 participants statewide of all ages, 8 to 80 and more, with an estimated 100,000 or more who could benefit from our program. Over the last 10 years, we have had 983% growth in our participation level. 983% growth in the last 10 years. Special Olympics Oregon programs are statewide and year-round. Our games are always, as we say, every day, every week, every month, every year. On any given day, except major holidays, there are Special Olympics activities underway all over Oregon. More than 1 in 8 Oregon students receive special education services, as I'm sure members of this committee know, in the state schools. And we have a very successful partnership with hundreds of Oregon schools, which we'll tell you more about. In fact, more than 2/3 of participants join Special Olympics Oregon through a school-based program. At the beginning of my remarks, I said that we come to you as partners here today. To serve on our mission, we rely on other partners. We rely on thousands of volunteers all over the state, nearly 7,000 every year. We did not pay them, well, they deserve to be paid, but they're priceless. Without them, we could simply not do what we do. In 30 Oregon counties, we provide our services through trained volunteer leadership teams, amazing Oregonians who give of their time, talent, and heart to serve year-round in our communities and schools. We have a major partnership with hundreds of Oregon schools, as I said, through our Unified Champion Schools Initiative, one of the most inspiring things I've seen. This includes unified sports, where students with disabilities, intellectual disabilities, are on the same team as students without intellectual disabilities. And it changes the lives of both of those sides. It includes our Respect Campaign, which is creating a culture of respect in many Oregon schools. These programs are all funded by Special Olympics Oregon. We have a long-standing partnership with Oregon's law enforcement community under the banner Law Enforcement Torch Run. These officers serve as key volunteer partners to Special Olympics Oregon activities statewide. We partner with the families of our participants through an organized family network, which provides ongoing source for the sharing of information, support, and counsel family to family. And we're partnered with Oregon State University, Senator Gelser, through our Oregon Team Wellness Initiative, which provides a unique curriculum in health and fitness developed by Special Olympics Oregon that teaches our constituency how to take care of themselves in their daily lives. This program has garnered national attention and has now been launched by four other states. Special Olympics Oregon is currently funded through the private sector, specifically foundations, corporate sponsors, and individual donors. Our annual budget is approximately $8.8 million, with additional in-kind support also significant. We partner in every way possible with many of Oregon's business and community leaders in raising the critical dollars to bring our programs to the thousands with intellectual disabilities whose lives are changed and made better because of Special Olympics Oregon. We are also a leader in fostering volunteerism in every community, engaging over 8,000 volunteers, as I said, throughout the state. As you might guess, the impact of Special Olympics Oregon is deep, wide, diverse, and measurable. And here to share a little bit more is the CEO of Special Olympics Oregon, Margie Hunt.
Thank you, Carrie. Excuse me. And Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Margie Hunt, and I'm the CEO of Special Olympics Oregon. And I have the privilege of sharing information about the impact of Special Olympics Oregon with you. There's solid empirical evidence on this, on the overarching impact of Special Olympics. Let me give you a few examples. Special Olympics has a powerful impact on the wider community by changing public attitudes towards people with intellectual disabilities. For example, studies have shown that support for inclusion of students with intellectual disabilities in regular classrooms increased from 2 to 55% as people became more involved with Special Olympics. Special Olympics also leads to greater opportunities for employment for those with intellectual disabilities. 52% of adult Special Olympics participants in the United States are employed. For adult individuals in the general population with intellectual disabilities who are not in Special Olympics, the percentage is just 34% or lower. And in the broadest sense, Special Olympics Oregon is impacting the very economy of our communities. Our programs focus on the development of tools for life, which lead to the following improved personal improvement. Increased social and communication skills. 90% of participants' family members report improvement in relationship skills and friendships, increased self-esteem and confidence, increased motor skills, improved cognitive skills, improved physical fitness, increased training in healthcare. And if you think about it, when you take the largest disability population in a community and in any community in any state, that is Special Olympics constituency. When that population is able to progress in these areas, they develop increased independence and are statistically more likely to hold a job or live alone. And as we perform our mission well, we impact the very economy of our communities. And this is one of the key reasons why other state legislatures, well over half, support their Special Olympics state chapters. So there are thousands of individual examples of the impact of Special Olympics life-changing programs on those we serve. Let me just share a few. There's a boy named Eric with intellectual disabilities, and he had lots of buddies in high school because he was just a cool guy, tall, good-looking kid. You'd have to talk to him for a few minutes, and you'd know he was one of ours. But he lost them all at graduation because they went on to college and jobs and marriage, and he did not. And then he said he got involved in Special Olympics. And at a board meeting, as he was telling us about this, he said he had found... Boy, oh boy. He had found his forever friends. There's a boy with severe autism who had never hugged either of his parents. That's not uncommon with autism. They're not comfortable being tactful. Then one day in a Special Olympics event, he ran right into his father's arms at the end of a race. It was the first time he had ever hugged his dad. There's Amelia with intellectual disabilities who used to be terribly bullied in her school until the school launched our respect campaign. And today, Amelia is a spokesperson for the cause. She helps lead and conduct assemblies, and she's a leader in Special Olympics Oregon respect campaign. And then there's Jimmy, who has intellectual disabilities as well as cerebral palsy, which you find in Special Olympics. Lots of times there's physical disability as well as intellectual, and who tried every year to complete the cross-country course in the Winter Games. He couldn't hold poles because of his CP, so he would fall, he would get up, and he would fall, and he would get up, until finally one year he made it through the whole course. Jimmy grinned. His mother cried, and the whole mountain cheered. There's Janice, a volunteer Special Olympics coach, who doesn't even have a child in the program, but who actively helps build and mold the lives of the Special Olympics Oregon participants she trains so that they can develop confidence and a belief in themselves. She is one of over 1,000 of certified Special Olympics Oregon coaches, and these are all volunteers. There is Marie, the elderly woman on a fixed income who worries for our organization if she can't make her $25 contribution that month. She is an inspiration and a constant reminder of the fiduciary responsibility we have to our donors, no matter how large or how small. In every Special Olympics story, there is a common thread. It's the revealing of the champion in all of us. The Special Olympics participant knows that he or she is different. They absolutely know that, and yet we are the same. They know what it means to be loved or not. They can set goals and achieve them. They can learn, compete, run the distance, be responsible, hold a job, have a vision, be leaders, and do great things. And in the process, they reveal the champion in all of us. They make us better. They make us dig deep, find the courage and strength to reach higher and do things we never thought we could do before. Chair Roblin and committee members, there is a powerful spirit to this work. You can't measure it, you just know it's there. And if you are a fan of dignity and respect and the human race, then you are already a fan of Special Olympics Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
And now if I might sort of wrap up this, I always hate being after Margie. I'm ready to cry, but I'll try to maintain my cool here.
I'm a weeper.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, Carrie and Margie have given you an overview of the tremendous impact of Special Olympics Oregon on the children and youth in our state, both in our schools and in our community programs. As you've heard, the bedrock of this organization is partnerships. Let me tell you why the state's partnership with Special Olympics Oregon is of the greatest importance at this time. There are three issues where schools across this country, including Oregon, are experiencing great pressure from state and federal governments as they try to solve these problems. This is also a set of three problems that citizens are putting pressure on to make sure they can be taken care of. So let me give you a picture of those three issues. The first issue, you've heard a lot about it, bullying in our schools, which threatens students' physical and emotional safety, negatively impacts their ability to learn, can lead to dropouts, and in extreme instances, even suicide. Leading the solution is a statewide respect campaign introduced and managed by Special Olympics Oregon in partnership with youth leadership in over 200 Oregon schools and growing. Students serve as leaders, conducting assemblies, writing and publishing respect articles, producing respect videos, actively using social media in general, promoting respect and inclusion in their schools. This highly successful campaign is conducted in collaboration with the Oregon Association of Student Councils, as well as OSAA, and has been endorsed by the National Association of State Boards of Education. The best way to address bullying is to stop it before it starts. And Special Olympics is on the front lines of this fight, and we are winning. The second issue, inequity in extracurricular opportunities for those with disabilities. As a result of recent reported findings by the federal government, schools are now required to solve this problem. Again, Special Olympics Oregon is a key partner to the state. Through the Unified Sports Program you just heard mentioned, programs in Oregon schools and students with and without disabilities are provided additional extracurricular sports opportunities year-round. Unified Sports Program and also fosters inclusion and greater understanding of all who have disabilities by those who do not. As with the Respect Campaign, Special Olympics Oregon Unified Sports Program is offered in collaboration with the Oregon School Activities Association, as well as other major education-related organizations in our state. The third issue, the obesity epidemic among school-aged children. The health and wellness of our children and youth continues to be a major challenge. Schools are required to implement policies and practices in the education environment to help curb this problem. And again, the state's partner, Special Olympics Oregon, is helping to meet this challenge. Under the banner, Wellness is a Sport, and in collaboration with the head of the OHSU Wellness Center and other health and fitness professionals, we've developed and copyrighted a year-round nutrition and fitness curriculum for individuals with intellectual disabilities that is also unified. Our team wellness program has been endorsed, and I want to show you one of the documents right here that is part of this program. Our team wellness program has been endorsed by the American Association of Health and Disability and is being instituted by Special Olympics state chapters in Washington State, Montana, Southern California, and Illinois. Oregon has been the national blueprint for that program. In 2016, expansion began in our Oregon schools, and it is continuing in 2017, and we hope it to continue until we don't need it anymore, and I think that will be a while. So, Mr. Chair and committee members, as you can see, Special Olympics Oregon is already your partner. We seek your support, but we do not come to you with an empty plate. We offer the power of partnerships established over many years that are the bedrock of our organization and that continue to fund statewide programs in Oregon schools. Special Olympics Oregon has never before requested state funding, although over half of Special Olympics state chapters around the country are supported with state dollars. But we believe our extensive work in our schools today that is helping Oregon meet key education requirements and improving the quality of the education experience for all students warrants our request at this time. Specifically, we are requesting funding of $1 million in this biennium's budget. The crucial funding would expand Special Olympics Oregon's capacity to meet the ever-increasing demand for unified champion schools, for Oregon team wellness, and for the respect campaign in Oregon's K through 12 schools across the state. These funds would contribute to a 42% increase in the number of schools participating in these important programs, all of which benefit students with and without intellectual disabilities. And these funds from the state would be matched by nearly between $7 and $8 million already contributed in the biennium by the private sector, including sponsorships, small individual gifts, major gifts, and many foundation grants. Now, as some of you know on this committee, I have a son with autism. That parental experience over many, many years gives me a very personal perspective on this issue. But again, please know I would not be here at this table if I did not know how impactful Special Olympics Oregon is to all the children and youth of this state, and how critically important this request for support truly is. This is an opportunity to make this public-private partnership work better than ever. So please join with many Oregonians who support the mission of Special Olympics Oregon to bring Oregon students the best educational environment that we can provide. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thank you. I didn't have a question. I just wanted to say thank you. I'm very grateful to have a son that has participated in Special Olympics since he was a young guy. He's now 22, and it's been exciting since he's left high school. One of my daughters has been really involved in the formation of their unified team at Corvallis High School, and what's really exciting about the unified team is how engaged the community gets. It's a sold out crowd at the gym. Everybody is there. The newspaper is there. It's just a wonderful thing for everybody that's involved, and it's exciting to see a Special Olympics kind of growing and changing as our times and perceptions change about inclusion and community involvement, the Respect campaign. It just, thank you for continuing the work and always making it fresh and new.
Thank you.
And we are really excited about our new partnership with Oregon State University. They are going to make this an even broader, more successful experience for the kids and participants who are going down there this summer for the summer games. They're actually going to stay in the dorms. It's going to be like an Olympics village. Mm-hmm. And we're very excited. They are reaching out to help us in every way they can to make this very even more successful now that it's going to be in Corvallis and have the sponsorship and support of the university. So we're quite excited about that.
Mm-hmm. And I assume you need volunteers. And there's plenty of opportunities for all of us to come and volunteer, sure. Including at the dance, which I'm told by many athletes is the highlight of the year.
Yes, that's very good.
So I just want to say thank you to each of you for taking your time to do this. As you know, this is a Ways and Means thing, but it's important for the policy committees to get an understanding of what's happening in the Ways and Means process, because we're going to get an opportunity, I hope, to vote for $1 million at some time on the floor to become part of this partnership. And as a high school principal, having had a lot of the games on our campus and then gone to the state meet and met with families and others at those when it was down at the University of Oregon, it is a really life-changing event when you see these kids and you see these opportunities. And when you see a number of these who remain citizens in your local communities forever, and see them out on the street and have something to talk to them about and to, remember the day, and then they'll tell you that they're still involved, they're still doing Special Olympics. It's really a really great thing to have been a part of and actually to continue to. So we'll look forward to seeing Sarah at Oregon State working hard.
I'll be there.
I know.
If each of you were to whisper in Senator Devlin's ear, yeah, when the time comes. So.
That's right.
Or in someone's ear.
Someone's ear.
Right. Exactly.
Yes.
But I think if they understood from the voices on this committee how important this work is, it might help in the Ways and Means process to make sure this is not just seen as wouldn't it be nice, but isn't it necessary?
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between nice and necessary with these families, these children, and the future. I mean, they're going to make differences in our communities that would not have happened without Special Olympics. So thank you.
And I would just add, if yes. I could very quickly, Chair, that the worst perception in the world for Special Olympics would be for anyone to think that it's just fun.
Right.
It's not. It becomes the life. This is the life. This is the social life that this whole constituency has. So it's so critical we never go backwards. That's the unthinkable part. So thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. And Governor, thanks for staying engaged and involved.
not that anybody would have ever,
anybody who knows you would ever think you wouldn't, but it's still truly impressive that you've been here.
Well, and I wish all of you well. I know this is going to be a tough session,
yeah.
And to come and ask for financial help in this session is not an easy thing to do for those of us who know how difficult this is. So I wish you a successful session in the work you're doing in this committee and others. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we're going to close our informational meeting on Special Olympics, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2565. And we're going to invite Representative Witt to the stage. Thank you for your patience, Representative Witt. And we'll open that public hearing, and we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 2565 modifies priority enrollment system to offer course registration to continuing qualified students prior to continuing non-qualified students within the same credit year classification. The bill requires public universities and community colleges to accommodate priority registration for new qualified students as practicable pursuant to institutional orientation requirements.
Okay. Representative Witt.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2565, a bill designed to hopefully facilitate additional educational opportunities for veterans and their dependents. This bill is a successor to House Bill 2645 from the 2015 session, which established a priority registration system in higher education for active military members, honorably discharged veterans, and eligible dependents of veterans. The only problem with that bill is that the priority registration option has only been available to enrollees during their first quarter of school. And as a result of that, veterans, our universities, community colleges, our state's Veterans Department, as well as a veterans work group, have all requested that the program be extended to additional quarters throughout an individual's higher education career. And if you think about it, the option of priority registration actually becomes more valuable as you progress through your college career, simply because assuming that you're taking all of your required courses as you go along each term, the fewer courses that you have when you get close to graduation, the more the demand is to get that particular course because you absolutely require it, and you may not have any other options. This has been a program that has been very successful to a lot of veterans who whose lives may be quite different than those of your typical college-aged university student, someone perhaps coming just out of high school, family obligations, career obligations, perhaps even instances of PTSD, a host of other issues, oftentimes make college a challenge to many Yet, as I think most of us know, the rewards are very, very significant. House Bill 2645 opened the door for additional educational opportunities for veterans. House Bill 2565 promises to keep those doors open, and on that account, I would encourage your positive action on the bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and for your hearing the bill. I would be happy to try and answer any questions that I might.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Witt? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
We have Amy Clark and William Elfring. And thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
And whoever wants to go first.
That will be me. So, good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, and members of the committee. My name is Amy Clark, and I'm the registrar for Western Oregon University. I'm here today to speak to you on behalf of all seven public universities in Oregon in support of House Bill 2565. I would like to start just by saying how grateful I am to Representative Witt for sponsoring this legislation and to the committee for affording us the opportunity to speak here today. We recognize the commitment and sacrifice of our veterans and their families and the unique circumstances that they face relative to their registration and some of the requirements they face relative to using VA benefits to fund their education. They're under a lot of compressed timelines, regulatory scrutiny just for the use of their benefits, and so it is very critical to them to be able to enroll in the right classes and move swiftly through their degree. We support this legislation. We feel that it is something that can be implemented on our campuses. We've had a lot of internal conversations on our campuses as well as interinstitutional conversations regarding how we might implement better registration processes that serve our student veterans better as well as our entire student body. And we feel that this bill is certainly something we could implement in that way. And the conversations have been positive. I've heard from colleagues at Oregon State University that they've received positive feedback from their veterans population for the process they engaged in having this conversation and being involved in how we might do this better. We at Western Oregon University, we modeled our priority registration system when we implemented Priority for Veterans on this bill, as we felt that it was the spirit of what we wanted to do, the type of service that we wanted to provide. As Representative Witt mentioned, for it to not be a first quarter event, that we have continual support for veterans throughout their career. And that has been well received on our campus and has been effective. My conversations with my colleagues has indicated across all campuses that this is a bill that can be implemented and maintained and be successful across our campuses. We feel this is just a very important service to our students that we can provide, and that this new bill, the House Bill 2565, provides us the framework to provide a better service than we have under the previous bill. That's all I have. Just in closing, I wanted to thank the committee open up for any questions you may have of me.
Okay. We'll hear both of you, and then we'll have questions.
Sir Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, my name is William Elfring. I'm the Military and Veterans Resource Advisor at Oregon State. Here, of course, in favor of House Bill 2565. As Representative Witt mentioned, it becomes more difficult the further you go in your academic career to get the classes you need. And the VA, for those using benefits, only pays for programs that are in your degree program. So if you can't get that one, they're not going to pay you to pick up the extra 3 credits so you can have your full benefit for that term. So it becomes increasingly important along the way. And with changes in higher education, it's tough for these students if they get all their classes to make it through on 36 months. If they don't make it through while they have their benefits, the chances of them making it through without them is very diminished. So giving them priority registration above their peers in that class will help them to be more successful and to make through their academic pursuit.
Thank you. So any questions for either? I guess my question is, do the veterans self-select? Do they tell you who they are, or do you have another way of knowing who veterans are that are coming to your universities?
There's various means. So veterans are getting benefits, identify themselves to the university because there's, again, those regulatory hoops that we have to jump through to make sure they get their benefits. And for students that aren't using benefits, schools have mechanisms for them to self-identify as veterans, and I think this is an important tool that gives them more of a reason maybe to self-identify if they're not using benefits, because there are a lot of services on campus available to student veterans that they may not know about if we don't know about them.
So that's my other question. How do they know that we have this benefit? How are we getting the information out to veterans?
I imagine it will vary on campuses, but between the veterans coordinators and the registration notices that are sent out by campuses, if this bill moves forward, part of that will be a campaign to get that word out to students.
Okay. Any other questions for these people? Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
So with that, there's no one else unless there's someone sitting back in the audience that was waiting to have an opportunity that didn't sign up. I see no one rushing. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2565, and I'll look to my right and left. I anticipate putting this on as a work session at the next meeting. Is there anybody? Okay. So we will do that. We closed our House Bill 2565. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2314. Kyle Thomas. There we go. And we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, House Bill 2314 allows the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to set minimum standards by rule for graduation from hair design, barbering, aesthetics, or nail technology schools.
There we go.
Thank you, Chair Roland, Vice Chair Linthic, and members of the committee. My name is Kyle Thomas. I'm the Director of Legislative and Policy Affairs for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Just like the bill before you last week, Senate Bill 54, this is another bill that's fairly technical, also fairly lengthy. So this is a HEC-sponsored bill. I do hope you'll support it, but I'll just take a couple of minutes just to run section by section to let you know what each provision is meant to accomplish. Probably the most substantive change in the entire bill is Section 1, which removes cosmetology instructional hour standards from statute and gives the HEC authority to propagate those standards by rule. All this section is meant to do is provide a little bit more flexibility. The HEC is a commission that meets annually. It has stakeholder groups that meet on the issue of cosmetology and on the issue of the curricula associated with meeting the requirements for licensure that the Health Licensing Office puts forth. And so by shifting these standards from statute to rule, you're actually aligning that process more akin to other specific instructional hour requirements that HEC is responsible for. The fact that these hour standards are in statute is actually a rarity. It is more often the case that these are established by rule and by policy. That's the extent of the change in Section 1. There, it also, I should say, since there was a discussion in the House committee, puts proficiency-based schools into this rulemaking as well. Prior to the passage of this legislation, if it should pass, proficiency-based schools simply issued essentially a work plan to the commission, and the commission deemed it to be acceptable or unacceptable. This changes the process slightly by which the proficiency-based schools will have to meet the standards that are established by HEC in rule as well. It would provide a little bit more certainty to the proficiency-based schools that a plan that they submit would be accepted or not accepted. They're also going to contain credit hour equivalencies in our rule, which we think will help these institutions for the purposes of accreditation and being eligible for financial aid. And I'll just briefly go down the rest of the section. Section 2 clarifies one section of the ORS to indicate that HEC is responsible for approving university mission statements versus reviewing them. One statute we have says approve, one says review. The HEC, by practice, does approve these statements, and this brings that language into alignment. Sections 3 through 5 clarify that it's HEC and not the State Board of Education that oversees the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. Section 6 clarifies the activities around the Aspire program and the work that the volunteer mentors in that program do in working with not only high school students, but with middle school students and college students as well. Sections 7 through 9 clarifies that the commission has the same authority as other state agencies do with regard to contracting and state grant administration. And I have asked through the administrator this afternoon and through the chair for a small amendment. Currently, on page 7, lines 13 through 18, you'll see that there is an or. And that means that if this bill passes, HEC will have either the authority to enter into contracts and grant agreements or the authority to establish technical and advisory committees to pursue that to pursue its work. That is a drafting error. We are meant to it was the intent that we would be meant to have both authorities. So we have submitted for an amendment to change that to an and statement. Two more sections. Section 10, 23, and 33 through 61 simply change the title of the Office of Community Colleges and Workforce Development's chief from executive director to director, recognizing that now that that office is a part of the HEC and not a standalone office. And then finally, sections 14 through 32 amend statutes regarding the high school proficiency exams in the event that the state of Oregon adopts other proficiency examination measures other than the GED. The higher education statutes would be aligned and allow for that eventuality. It does not actually approve an additional proficiency exam, but there are other alternatives to the GED that are in use in other states.
So, yes, Senator Hess.
Thank you. I noticed in one of the versions there was a financial transfer of interest earning money to the community foundation, which I mean, I was with you all, and then I saw that, saying, "Wow, but that seems like another chapter from another book." Visiting this book.
Sure. So, in the initial proposed legislation, sections 11 through 13 transferred $900,000. It's the principal, the corpus of a scholarship fund that's, I believe, meant for barbering and hairdressing. We had a conversation with the previous treasurer prior to developing that legislative proposal, and after the new proposal came out and a new treasurer took office, they had indicated that they had some concerns over that proposal. Additionally, we learned through the process that we were perhaps, by transferring money from the HECS authority to the Oregon Community Foundation, probably setting a little bit more precedent than we wanted to set. Yeah. In a bill such as this. We do have a long-standing relationship with the Oregon Community Foundation. Our Office of Student Access and Completion actually manages the scholarship administration process for scholarships that are issued with funds that are invested in the Community Foundation. So to that extent, we did not view this necessarily as a increase or a modification of that relationship we already had with them, but we do understand that there are state dollars involved, and that probably merited a bigger discussion than was allowed for in the initial proposal.
Then, so how do we solve that? Is there a problem then that you need to fix, or it's just not going to be addressed?
The problem is that the $900,000 is not achieving the interest rate returns that it could otherwise be achieving if it was invested in different instruments. So we've had conversations with the current treasurer about the possibility of investing those funds in a more appropriate vehicle. We have to sit down with them and have a conversation that will hopefully lead to a conclusion that allows us to generate better interest rates on that investment. But ultimately, the size of the pot and the scholarships we're able to issue is smaller as a result of having those funds invested in an account that's meant for very short-term investments in the treasurer's office.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
Just a comment. I wonder how people were ever able to get their hair cut or their nails done before the state got involved. Interesting.
We've always had barber schools.
We've always had barber schools, and the market took care of it. Okay, you know. I just find it interesting, all the things that the state feels it needs to be involved in that it probably doesn't.
I've also seen some of these groups come to the state and ask, we want to have some certification so we're all doing the same thing. So it can go both ways sometimes. But okay, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Again, we are waiting for an amendment. When we get that amendment, we'll get a hold of people with respect to whether we're going to move the bill. So we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 2314. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2457, and we'll have Cindy Robert come on up and bring anybody you want with you. Kristen Granger, thank you. And we'll have a short explanation. I guess we're having, a replacement for Cindy Robert.
That's possible.
Okay, that's good. So we'll have a short explanation.
Chair Rowland, members of the committee, House Bill 2457 modifies the Higher Education Coordinating Commission process to review and appropriately act on student complaints regarding any school operating in Oregon. It restricts HEC to investigating and resolving student complaints that relate to state financial aid. It allows HEC to refer a student complaint to the appropriate state agency if the complaint alleges that a school has violated a state law concerning consumer protection, civil rights, employment rights, or environmental quality, or the school's accrediting association if the complaint relates to school's authorization to offer academic degree programs or to the quality of the school's academic degree programs, or to the school at which the student is enrolled if HEC determines that the complaint should be resolved through the school's internal review process. The bill defines a school as an independent not-for-profit institution of higher education and clarifies that schools do not include schools that offer degrees in theology or religious occupations. The bill prohibits public record disclosure of student complaints.
Thank you. And whoever wants to start first.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Kristen Granger, the new president of the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities, representing Oregon's 18 private nonprofit independent colleges and universities that educate more than 35,000 students. One in five of Oregon's undergraduate degrees and nearly half of Oregon's graduate degrees are conferred by schools like Willamette, Lewis and Clark, Reed College, Pacific, George Fox, Linfield, and other Alliance member nonprofit institutions. And many, many thanks for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 2347. Oregon's nonprofit colleges and universities care deeply about the student experience. Higher education is one of those rare sectors of commerce where the customer and the product are one and the same. Indeed, a high-quality educational experience is the hallmark of the private school brand, and resolving complaints is critical to that. Alliance member colleges and universities are committed to student satisfaction and success, and there's strong evidence to suggest we're walking that talk. In my just under 100 days into my presidency, I've reviewed data presented to the 2015 legislature that indicated the total number of complaints HEC had received from the students at Alliance member schools was fewer than five. And since 2015, HEC reports having received just three complaints about private higher education. And actually, it's not clear if those complaints are from the nonprofit or for-profit sector, but nonetheless, there's just three. But regardless, we support the idea that students at all colleges and universities, public and private, should be able to register complaints with government and other entities charged with resolving them. We would further contend that ideally, registering a complaint should be a simple and accessible process that doesn't require students to research the statutes in order to find out how or where to register their complaint. We want students to feel comfortable reporting their concerns, removing barriers that might discourage students from otherwise acting on their own in their own best interest. As you may recall, the legislature passed a bill in 2015 in response to the federal mandate that all states devise and implement a student complaints process. A lot more is now known about the expectations of federal authorities, and the Alliance has been working closely with HEC to offer revisions to our 2015 statute that clarify and streamline the complaints process for students at private nonprofit colleges and universities. House Bill 2457 is the outcome of those discussions. This bill offers students a straightforward and accessible way to seek redress of complaints, one that is cost-effective and efficient to administer and achieves federal compliance. It establishes the HEC as the point of contact for any student complaint, a sort of one-stop shop, so students don't have to figure out who the appropriate entity is to address their complaints to. It maintains confidentiality of student complaints so that students feel safe and comfortable sharing them. And it empowers the HEC to refer the complaint to the appropriate governmental entity charged to address it. The bill requires a report to the governor about the number and nature of such complaints, and the sunset provision ensures a follow-up conversation about the policy and process, what's working and what isn't. 2457 was adopted unanimously by the House, and I appreciate the opportunity appreciate your support of our efforts in service of Oregon students. I'd be happy to answer any questions about it.
Thank you. We'll go on, and then we'll have questions for both of you.
Great. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, or the HEC. Appreciate the work that we've been able to do with the Alliance on this bill. Just had a few comments to offer related to the substance of it. One of the things that makes the HEC a complicated organization, as you know, is that we have different responsibilities for the different sectors within Oregon higher education. For the most part, this bill is focused on the sector that Kristen represents, the independent not-for-profit colleges and universities, including ones she mentioned and others she represents. And it addresses our authority, our responsibility for addressing student complaints that are made to the HEC about colleges or universities within that sector. And I think it's important just to note for the record, so there's as little as possible confusion going forward, sort of what authority this legislation provides for the HEC to resolve and respond to those complaints and what it doesn't. I think Kristen and your administrator have summarized that well. I'll just underscore the fact that this is a narrowing of the authority that was provided to the HEC in 2015 as a result of, as Kristen noted, the federal rule that was recently promulgated. We understand the Alliance's sort of concerns with what had been adopted and interpretation that this would satisfy federal authority. It would, for the most part, take the HEC out of the position of actually resolving those student complaints itself, and instead would allow us to facilitate the resolution of those complaints by referring them to back to the institution in some cases, to other state authorities in other cases where there may be jurisdiction at other state agencies under existing law to respond to and address those student complaints, or potentially to the school's accreditation agency for resolution. We would not be tracking the outcome of that process, at least wouldn't have clear authority here to track the outcome of that process. So the report that would be required of us under the bill back to the governor would describe what we had done in the way of referrals, but would likely have little additional information over and above that. So I just wanted to do our part to try to ensure that folks, including legislators and then ultimately students and the members of the public, have a clear understanding of what the state higher education agency would and would not be doing under this bill should it become law. Again, appreciate the work that we've done with the Alliance to this point to get here.
Questions? Senator Lithgow.
There's two things. First, with regard to the reporting arena, why not categorize and track and follow up? And then the second question maybe you could address is the non-disclosure. The subsection 5 says a student complaint that's received, including but not limited to, in other words, that means everything, under section 4 is not subject to disclosure. And that seems like an odd disclosure exemption, redacting those, categorizing them, having verification and validation of how HEC is responding to the complaints seems perfectly appropriate.
Senator Roblin, Senator Linthicum, I will do my best to address both of those questions. In terms of the report to the governor by 2020, the language in the bill itself would provide that we report on the number of complaints that we have received, the type of complaints that we've received and our disposition of those complaints, meaning what did we do, and what we will do is refer them, typically, unless they involve one of our state financial aid programs that we administer, we'll refer them to an institution or to accreditation or to another agency. Certainly, we could make some effort to track what happens, but I don't believe that agencies or institutions would be compelled to tell us what has happened. And in fact, they may feel like they can't tell us what has happened to these potentially sort of confidential complaints that we've referred to them, but they then may investigate or act upon. And so I wanted to be clear here that we cannot commit under this bill to being able to describe in that report the ultimate outcome of the student complaint. It goes back to the institution. It goes through an institutional process, which may or not be accessible to us in terms of the outcome of it under current law. In terms of the other question with respect to confidentiality, just a couple of things to note. One, this provision, which you picked up on, is not limited to student. So whereas everything we've talked about essentially so far is limited to student complaints arising from the independent not-for-profit sector that Kristen represents, the provision that you just cited is intentionally drafted here to apply to all student complaints that we receive from any sector of higher education for which we're responsible. So it's a broader provision. And it does, in our reading of this language, it does mean that those complaints and the materials associated with them would not be subject to disclosure under public records law. It is our expectation and certainly our intent that a sort of any action that's taken by the commission relative to a school, so typically, and I'm thinking not really so much about Kristen's sector, but in the regulated private sector, for example, where we have quite a bit more authority, a student complaint can result ultimately in investigation and action by the commission against a school. That's very rare, but it can occur. We have regulatory authorities, and certainly our understanding is that this provision would not shield that from disclosure. Mm-hmm. It's very important that the public would know if and when the state is acting upon a student complaint to sanction a school. But the investigation, the complaint itself and the investigatory materials associated with it would be kept confidential. That was raised as an issue in part because of student concern about, for example, retaliation. If their complaint was splashed all over the media or otherwise got into the hands of the public or the school, could result in certain consequences for them.
Sheriff, I could, yeah. Just to follow up on that, as part of the Public Records Task Force, the Attorney General convened, what institutions do is one thing as far as disclosure, but protecting the information of citizens and individuals, in this case the students, is of prime concern and prime importance. So I think that does speak to that. So.
Any other questions? And I want to say, I want to thank you for the testimony, because we know that HEC has a number of different, I guess I could call them clients, who have their own individual expectations of that interaction. And with the private nonprofit institutions, they are private nonprofits for a reason, and they don't want to have and don't expect to have a lot of oversight from HEC. And we didn't expect them to have a lot of oversight from HEC. So I'm pleased that in this particular session you could tighten it down so that it really does what everybody wants it to do, i.e. give that simple place for one-place shop for anybody who wants to make a complaint, but not intrude too much into the workings of your institutions, because that's not the job of HEC.
Yeah. I'd also say go Bearcats, but what the heck, so, okay.
So any other questions? Thank you both for being here, and the only person who was on our list who chose not to come up here was Cindy Robert, and it doesn't look like she's looking to come up, so I think we're good.
She probably signed up on the wrong page.
No, she didn't actually sign up. She was just our contact person for this bill. And again, I'm going to expect that we're going to put this on for a work session next time, just to let people know. Okay. So with that, we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2457, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2457. So I think Senator Johnson's here, so if you would like to wait for half an hour or so, we could do that before you open this one. But I know he is here. That's what I said. We could wait for half an hour.
Actually, he's not a senator. A
representative.
Okay.
But if you'd like to wait a little longer and have him be here just for... No.
I'm going
to
hang out?
No, yeah. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2147. We're going to ask Senator Representative Johnson to come up forward. And anybody who wants to bring for help and support.
Bring my...
And we'll have our
bodyguard back up here with me.
Our committee administrator explain the bill.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill... Oh, sorry. The A2 amendment replaces the measure. It requires higher education institutions to provide the following information to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission annually: the number of Oregon high school graduates from each school district enrolled at the institution, and the graduation rate at that institution for Oregon high school graduates from each school district. The bill requires HEC to submit that information to the Oregon Department of Education and requires ODE to provide that information to school districts. The bill excludes career schools.
Mr. Chair, I do find it interesting that a bill that passed the House, I'm assuming unanimously, gets gut and stuffed in the Senate, but that's just interesting. So,
it's a friendly gut and stuff, though, Senator.
So with that,
thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Mark Johnson, you represent House District 52. Good to see you all. I don't know if I've been in front of your committee yet this session.
No, so you might have been one.
We'll be here.
Okay.
There'll be more opportunities for us to collaborate. This is a bill that's just, you know, it's one of those type of bills that occasionally, you know, I'm sure you all can relate to. You come upon a topic and you say, my gosh, why aren't we doing that already? And this is a topic that my superintendent, Dan Goldman, and from our Hood River County School District put on my plate when he came down here in February. He said, we just need better data from our colleges and universities about where our Oregon graduates are going and where they're enrolling. And there isn't a regular reporting mechanism in play right now to provide that information back to school districts. So that's really what this bill is all about. It's not a very complicated bill. It just simply requires that East Post-Secondary Institution Oregon report back to the HEC the information when K-12 graduates from Oregon High School enroll in their institution. In addition, then, the institutions must report when that student graduates, because currently there isn't an automatic pipeline of that information. And as you can imagine, it can be a little frustrating for school districts, as, again, we're all trying collectively to achieve our 40-40-20 aspirational goals. If we're not able to get good data sometimes, it's just difficult for us to know. So this can provide great information for local school districts about, again, just where their students are going, what the retention rates look like, how they're succeeding. Maybe certain high schools have a better admission and or, you know, retention rate than other high schools in that district. So it could provide some really valuable tools. So, and again, as we continue to wait for that long promised longitudinal data system within the state of Oregon, this would be a wonderful bit of data that would be automatically included in that. But until that system is up and operating, we must continue to do that. Now, there is a clearinghouse that ODE uses to provide graduation information to students. There's a federal program, but it doesn't have specific information about the student's originating district. So this would provide more clarity and would give our district some valuable information. So, again, as you heard, the committee administrator brought up the Dash 2 amendments, which does exempt the Northwest Career Colleges, which were an oversight in the House version. So that's why we're asking for this friendly amendment from our good colleagues here in the Senate. So that's basically it. You have a letter of support on file from my superintendent, Dan Goldman, Hooter Valley School District. OSBA is also supportive, and I'll let maybe them chime in from their perspective as well. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Roblin, members of the committee. Richard Donovan on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. As the representative mentioned, you do have my written testimony. OSBA is in support of the bill today as amended. The representative covered a lot of the ideas in terms of 40-40-20 alignment. The way that we kind of look at this is that this is, to paraphrase former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, this is getting at those unknown unknowns. There's a lot of information that school districts know anecdotally, that they know that kids experience success in these programs and they have kind of their finger on the pulse, but they don't have any sort of objective data. They don't really know, and they don't know what they don't know about who went but didn't make it, things like that. And we think that this type of relatively low-cost, straightforward information would be really valuable in a ballot, post-ballot Measure 98 world, where we're talking about P20 alignment and the kind of ways that high schools are going to have to create and manage programs that demonstrate post-high school success. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions you have. Otherwise, good bill do pass.
So, questions? I guess my big question is, all institutions now accept this one group? So all the private colleges would be doing the same thing?
Exactly.
All the junior
colleges, universities, public and private.
Except for this Northwest?
Career colleges.
Yeah. Okay, so.
They're a very different student population, obviously.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
So that's in
a nutshell. And it would be individual student and GPA?
We're not asking for GPA, just simply admission and graduation.
Graduation. Okay.
Coming in, leaving.
Okay.
That would be getting a little more complicated.
Yeah.
Not a bad idea long
term.
They
actually have that data. I mean, they send out graduation lists to us for all sorts of things. Not graduation, honor roll lists and other kinds of stuff. So they
exactly.
know the information.
Right. They do.
It's just how we want to use it and so on and so forth. And that might be a little more intrusive from a student perspective.
When Representative Johnson is sponsoring a bill, I kind of question about with Senator Hass as a chief sponsor. I figure it has to be a good bill. So.
Pays to have friends in high places.
I can't think of any other. And it obviously, what you got it down to the cost is not much because it didn't go through Ways and Means. So
that's correct.
The universities have agreed that they can get this information fairly easily to districts. Okay.
It's just distributing what they already know.
That's probably true.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
It's just sharing.
It just seems like, that each one of these schools is responsible to get stuff back to 197 districts. That seems complicated, but if it's in the right form, I guess that's pretty easy to do.
Well, and as you well know, some of the reporting mechanisms required for school districts to give information back to ODE.
That's true.
So it's about time to get a little more information
on the other
back.
Direction.
A little reciprocal.
That is true.
Right?
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wants to come up forward? They haven't had a chance to speak to the committee. They're interested. Nope, don't see anyone. So, pardon? Yeah. And so with this, we're going to close our public hearing. Do we want a work session on this bill? Is everybody okay with this? And are we ready?
You only next have time. It scheduled for public hearing.
Right now. No, I don't mean today. I mean next.
Oh, yeah. We'll do the,
we're fine
do
with everybody else.
Okay.
So we have the amendment already, so we're good there. So let's put it on the agenda for next time. With that, we'll close our public hearing on House Bill 2147. Is there any information that any one of our members? I will say this as a general information. Senator Cruz and I have talked repeatedly about having some ongoing meetings with regard to looking at the structure of the education system in Oregon.
Senator Cruz does not enjoy talking about that.
Pardon?
Senator Cruz does not enjoy talking about that.
Oh, I love talking
about that. He has never talked to me about that,
is even that right?
one
ever?
Time over
not
the last 12
ever,
years.
Ever?
Ever, ever.
So we're planning on getting a small group to start with. We'll look at in joining. We don't want to have a quorum, so the two of us will be there. We will get all the information that we're gathering. Right now we're gathering information from ECS on the ways that other states do their organization. We're looking at how the different organizations, if there's any relationship to that, and the National Center for Education Statistics on how they have done on different tests of math and whatever, so see if there's any relationship between how they're organized and how they seem to function. We'll get other information as we go on. All of that we will send to our committee members so you guys get the same stuff. We have a chart of the current organizational chart and a current organizational chart of higher ed, which is pretty complicated. So we'll have all of that for you as we start going. It looks like by the nature of how many bills that are coming, we will be having meetings on Tuesdays, but not every Thursday, and we'll start having some of these meetings at the same time on Thursday, so you guys will be excused. And that starts on about April 11th, I think, is somewhere in that neighborhood. So just so people know. And it doesn't look like our workload is going to be much more than needed for just having Tuesday meetings.
I think one thing I've noticed that in this session anyway, both chambers, a fair percent of the bills going through the Education Committee end up in Ways and Means.
Yeah,
so.
I agree.
Too many,
yeah, that's true. So with that, and if there are people who are very interested in that, please let Lisa Gazelter know that is something they'd be interested in. We'll get down. We'll get started with a group of people a little smaller. We may eventually invite more, but we want to make sure that we get all the data we need to begin with to start making better decisions for the future. So with that, we're going to close our Senate Education Committee today, April 25th, 2017. Thanks for all being here.